He was careful to conceal his preparations for the theft of the diamonds from Louise, and this was made easier by the distance that she had for long now been maintaining between them. Though they shared the thatched hut that Lobengula's men had built for them in the grove beyond the royal kraal, and though they ate the same meals of beef and sour milk and stone-ground maize cakes that the king sent down to them each evening, Louise spent her days alone, riding out on one of the mules in the early morning and not returning until dusk. Her mattress of straw in the furthest recesses of the hut she had screened with the tattered canvas sunshade from the cart, and he only once tried to pass the screen. "Not again," she hissed at him. "Never again." And she showed him the knife that she kept under her skirts. So he was able to work uninterrupted during the day, and to hide his equipment under his own mattress each evening. He carved the mask from the naturally curved portion of a hollow tree trunk, a hideous, grimacing, ape-like visage with staring eyes and gaping mouth full of white fangs, and he painted it with the colours from Kathy's paint-box. From the plumed ostrich skin he tailored a cloak that reached from neck to ankles, and for his feet and hands he made grotesque mittens of black goatskin. In full costume, he was enough to paralyze even the bravest warrior with supernatural terror. He was the very embodiment of the Tokolosh of Matabele mythology. Robin Codrington had given him repeated doses of laudanum for the persisting pain in his leg. But he had saved these for the occasion. He had decided on one of the Matabele festivals, and he waited until the third night when every man and woman of the entire nation, surfeited with beer and 3 days and nights of wild dancing, had fallen asleep where they fell. At nightfall, he gave the laudanum to Louise in a cup of soured milk, and the tart flavour concealed the musky taste of the drug. An hour after dark, he crept across the hut, drew aside the screen, and listened to her even breathing for a minute before leaning over her and slapping her cheeks lightly. She did not move nor murmur, and the rhythm of her breathing did not alter. He dressed swiftly in the feather cloak, not yet donning the mask and mittens, but blackening his face and limbs with a mixture of crushed charcoal and fat. Then, with the mask and a length of rope under one arm and a heavy assegai in the other hand, he crept out of the hut. The grove was deserted. No Matabele would venture here when the spirits were abroad, so he hurried through it, and from the tree line surveyed the stockade of the royal kraal. There was a sliver of the old moon rising, and it gave just enough light for him to pick his way, but not enough to betray him to watchful eyes. There would be few eyes open on this night. Even so, he crouched low as he crossed the open ground. The cloak made a shaggy hyena shape that would excite no real interest. At the outer stockade he paused to look and listen, then flicked the length of manila rope over the barrier of sharpened poles. He climbed up carefully, favouring his bad leg, and peered into the kraal. It was deserted, but a low watchfire burned in front of the barred gateway. Mungo slid down the rope, and he crossed quickly to the shadows of the nearest hut, and there paused to pull on his mittens and settle the cumbersome mask over his head before creeping on again towards the inner stockade that guarded the women's quarters. In the preceding weeks, using his brass telescope from the vantage point of the nearest hilltop, he had been able to see over the walls and to study the layout of the wives' quarters. There was a double circle of huts, like the concentric rings of a target, but at the centre, the bullseye, was a larger hut with intricate patterns of thatch and lacing proclaiming its greater importance. His guess that this was the king's sister's residence had been confirmed when he had seen through the telescope Ningji's elephantine gleaming naked body escorted by a dozen handmaidens emerging into the early sunlight from the low doorway. Now he reached the gateway in the inner stockade and studied it from around the sheltering wall of the nearest hut. Again his luck held. He had been prepared to use the assegai here, but both the guards were stretched out, wrapped in their furs, and neither of them moved as Mungo stepped over their prostrate bodies. From inside one hut, he heard the low, regular snores of one fat wife, and in another, a woman coughed and muttered in her sleep. But though his nerves jumped, he went on swiftly. The door to Ningji's hut was closed. Mungo had honed the edge of the assegai to a razor edge, and with it he sawed through the fastenings of bark rope that secured the opening. The rasp and rustle of the blade sounded thunderous in his ears, and his skin prickled as he waited for a shouted challenge from within. It did not come, but he found that he was sweating as he stepped back and brought out the bladders of goat's blood from under the cloak. He slit the bladders and splashed the stinking, congealing blood over the portals of the doorway. He had learned from the twins, who were authorities on the supernatural, that a tokolosh always spurted blood on any doorway through which it passed. It was one of the creature's most endearing characteristics. Now, with the assegai gripped in his right hand, Mungo stooped into the hut and crouched in the doorway. He waited for his eyes to adjust to the gloom. The fire in the centre of the large hut had burned low. There was just enough light to make out two figures curled like dogs on the sleeping mats on each side of it, and beyond it the ponderous bulk of the princess under her furs. Her snores started as a low grumbling, like a volcano, and rose to a whistling crescendo that covered any sound Mungo might make as he slipped across to the first of the sleeping handmaids. Before he could stir, he had slipped a gag of goatskin into her mouth and trussed her at the ankles and wrists with a leather thong. She did not struggle, but stared up at his horrific mask with huge white eyes in the firelight. He tied and gagged the second woman before crossing to Ninji's sleeping platform. That afternoon, as one of the king's guests, Mungo had watched Ningi sitting beside her brother and swilling pot after pot of French champagne. She went on snoring and grunting as he bound her arms and legs. Only when he thrust the gag into her gaping mouth did she snuffle and moan and come out of her alcoholic slumbers. He rolled her off the platform, and she fell with a thump to the clay floor. He dragged her across to where her bound servants lay. It was heavy work, for she weighed 300 pounds or more. He threw a log on the fire, and when it flared, he pranced and capered around his captives, thrusting his hideous mask into their faces and gibbering at them in fiendish menace. In the firelight, their sweat of fear burst out and ran in little rivulets down their bodies as they writhed and wriggled against their bonds. Suddenly there was a spluttering explosive rush as Ningi voided her bowels with sheer terror, and the hot stink of feces filled the hut. Mungo threw a fur kaross over them, and immediately they were still. Their grunts and muffled groans ceased. He moved quickly then. Returning to the sleeping platform, he threw the furs aside and found a pallet of woven bamboo. It lifted like a trapdoor, and in the low recess below it were a dozen small clay pots. His hands began to shake as he reached for one and lifted it out of the recess. His own sweat half blinded him, but through his blurred vision he saw the soapy gleam of reflected firelight in the mouth of the pot. He could not take it all. There was too much for him to carry, and too much for him to later conceal. Moreover, his survivor's instinct warned him that the more he took, the more remorseless would be the search and pursuit. He spilled the contents of all 12 pots into a glittering heap beside the fire, and in its uncertain light made his choice of the biggest and brightest stones from the hundreds that teased him with their twinkling smiles. 30 of them filled the leather drawstring bag he had brought with him. He tied it back at his waist, snatched up the assegai, and slipped out of the hut. The guards at the inner stockade still slept, and he passed them silently. Below the wall of the outer stockade, he stripped off his cloak, mittens, and mask, and dropped them on the untended watchfire. Then he heaped branches over them. There would be only ash by the morning. He went up the rope swiftly, hand over hand, and pulled it up after him. The royal kraal behind him was silent in heavy midnight stupor, and he climbed lightly down the outer wall of the stockade. He bathed in the pool below the camp, washing off the charcoal and fat, and then found his shirt and breeches where he had left them, in the hollow of a tree trunk beside the pool. In the hut he knelt beside Louise and placed one hand, still icy cold from the pool, upon her cheek. She sighed and rolled over onto her side. He felt like laughing and shouting his triumph out loud. Instead, he hid the bag of precious stones under his mattress and rolled into his blanket. He did not sleep for the rest of the night, and in the dawn he heard the hubbub of superstitious fear from the king's kraal, the screams of women and the shouts of men loudly bolstering their courage against the spirits and the demons. "This is a cruel thing for a good king to do," Robin told Lobengula bitterly. "Nomuza, you are a wise woman, the wisest that I have ever known, but you do not understand the spirits and demons of Matabililand. I understand that the world is full of evil men, but that there are very few evil spirits. The thing that entered my sister's hut came from the air. All of the gates to the kraal were guarded by men unsleeping. They have sworn to me that they stood at their posts from dusk to dawn, with eyes wide and spears in their hands. Nothing passed them. Even your best men can doze, and then lie to protect themselves. Nobody dare lie to the king. It came from air, and it sprayed rotten, stinking blood upon the portals of Ningi's hut." Lobengula shuddered despite himself. "On Chaka's scrawny buttocks, that is a tokolosh trick. No man can do that, except if he carry blood in a pot to hurl on the doorway." "Nomuza," Lobengula shook his head sorrowfully, "my sister and her servants saw this great hairy thing, black as midnight and stinking of the grave, with blood and not sweat oozing from its skin. Its eyes were like the full moon, and its voice that of a lion and eagle. It had no hands, no feet, just hairy pads." Lobengula shuddered again. "And it stole diamonds," Robin told him. "What does a demon want with diamonds?" "Who knows what a demon needs for his spells or his magic, or to please his darker master? Men lust after diamonds. Nomuza, to black men diamonds have no value, so it could not have been a black man. On the other hand, if a white man had entered my sister's hut, he would not have been satisfied with a few stones. A white man would have taken them all, for that is their way. So it could not have been either a white man or a black man. Who is left but a demon?" "Lobengula, great king, you cannot allow this thing to happen. Nomuza, there has been a terrible witchcraft perpetuated within the royal kraal. An evil person or many evil persons have conjured up a black demon, and I would be no king at all if I allowed them to live. The evil ones must be smelled out, and my birds must feast before we are cleansed of this filthy thing." "Lobengula, say no more, girl child of mercy. Words cannot divert my purpose, for you and your family and all the guests at my kraal are summoned to see justice done." It took 10 days for the Matabili people to come into Gubulawayo. They came in their regiments, warriors and maidens, ringed in doonas and fruitful matrons, the toddlers and the grey-headed, toothless old droolers, in their thousands and tens of thousands. And on the morning that Lobengula had appointed, the nation assembled, rank upon rank, regiment upon regiment, a black ocean of humanity that overflowed the great cattle stockade. There was a peculiar stillness over such an immense gathering. Only the plumed headdresses moved softly in the small, restless breeze, and a pall of fear hung over them, so palpable that it seemed to take the heat from the sun and dim its very rays. The silence was oppressive. It seemed to crush the breath from their lungs. Only once, when a black crow flew low over the serried ranks and screeched its raucous cry into the silence, all their heads lifted, and a soft sigh shook them, like the wind through the top branches of the forest. Before the gates of the royal kraal, facing this huge concourse, were drawn up the senior indunas of the Matabili, Somabula and Babian and Gandang, and the lesser princes of Kumalo, while behind them again, their backs to the poles of the stockade, were Lobengula's white guests, almost 100 of them, Germans and Frenchmen, Dutchmen and Englishmen, hunters and scholars and businessmen and adventurers, petitioners and missionaries and traders. Soberly clad in broadcloth, wearing hunting leathers and bandoliers, or dressed in spangled and gaudy uniform, they waited in the sweltering silence. There were only 2 white women present, for Robin had flatly refused to bring her daughters from Kami for the smelling-out ceremony, and Lobengula had relented and made an exception for them. The king had given permission for the 2 women to be seated. Robin sat beside the entrance to the stockade, and Clinton stood over her protectively while the members of Mr. Rhodes's deputation flanked her. Mr. Rudd, red-faced and whiskered, with his derby hat set four square on his head, and Jordan Ballantyne, bareheaded and golden-haired, at Robin's other hand. Further down the line of guests, Louise St. John sat on a stool of leather thongs. Her thick sable plaits hung to the waist of her simple white dress, and the eyes of the men around her kept returning surreptitiously to her exotic high-cheek beauty. Behind her stood Mungo St. John, one eye hidden by the black patch, leaning easily on his cane and smiling to himself as he saw the direction of the eyes of the men about him. The nation surged like a slumbering black sea, struck by a sudden gale of wind, and the plumes tossed like spume. There was a single clap of sound like the volley of massed cannon, as every right leg was lifted shoulder high and brought down to stamp the hard earth, and every throat corded and strained to the royal salute. Bayeti! The great black elephant of Matabele came through the gateway, and behind him, his wives, led by Ninji, swayed and shuffled and sang his praises. With the toy spear of kingship in his hand, Lobengula paced towards the mound of packed clay on which the bath chair, which had been his father's throne, was set, and Gundang and Babian, his brothers, came forward to help him ascend the steps. From his platform, Lobengula looked upon his people, and those closest to him saw the terrible sorrow in his eyes. "Let it begin," he said, and slumped into his chair. There was a ragged chorus of shrieks and whines and maniacal laughter from beyond the stockade walls, and through the gateway came a horrid succession of beldams and crones, of prancing hell hags and gibbering necromancers. At their throats and waists were hung the trappings of their wizardry, skull of baboon and infant, skin of reptile, of python and iguana, carapace of tortoise, and stoppered horns, rattles of lucky bean pods and bones, and other grisly relics of man and animal and bird. Wailing and hooting, they assembled before Lobengula's throne. "Dark sisters, can you smell the evil ones?" "We smell their breaths. They are here. They are here." One of the witches collapsed in the dust, with froth bubbling over her toothless gums. Her eyes rolled back into her skull, and her limbs twitched spasmodically. One of her sisters dashed the red powder from a snuff horn in her face, and she shrieked and leapt into the air. "Dark sisters, will you bring forth the evildoers?" Lobengula asked. "We will bring them to you, great bull of Kumalo. We will deliver them up, son of Mizilikatsi." "Go," ordered Lobengula. "Do what must be done." Some of them went whirling and cavorting, brandishing their divining rods. One the tail of a giraffe, another the inflated bladder of a jackal on a staff of red tambuti wood, still another the stretched and sun-dried penis of a black-maned lion, the rods with which they would point out the evil ones. Others crept away, slinking and sly as the night-prowling hyena. Others again crawled on all fours, snuffling the earth like hunting hounds quartering for the scent as they spread out amongst the rows of waiting people. One of the witches came down the line of white guests, hopping like an ancient baboon, her empty teats flapping against her withered belly, her skin crusty grey with filth, and her charms clattering and jangling. And she stopped in front of Mungo St. John, and lifted her nose to sniff the air. Then she howled like a bitch in season. Mungo St. John took the long black hand-rolled cheroot of native tobacco from between his lips and inspected the ash on its tip. The crone hopped closer and looked up into his face, and he returned the cheroot to his lips and returned her stare without interest. She leapt up to thrust her face inches from his and noisily sniff the breath of his nostrils, and then she danced away until she faced him again, lifted the long giraffe tail above her head, shrieked like a stooping owl, and rushed at Mungo, the tail raised to strike into his face. In front of him she froze in the act of striking, and Mungo St. John took the cheroot from his mouth, and he blew a perfect smoke ring that spun upon itself until it broke in the witch's face and blew away in soft wisps. She cackled wildly, madly, and passed on down the line to pause in front of Robin Codrington. "You stink like the hyena that spawned you," Robin told her evenly in perfect matabili, and the witch whirled and raced away to where Juba stood in the front line of noble matrons. She raised the switch to strike and looked back at Robin, gloating loathsomely. Robin had gone white as bone and came to her feet, clutching her own bosom. "No," she whispered. "Please, fair sister, let her be."